What are you hearing as far as the work that's being done by the conference committee? Could we see some type of pension action here in the fall session?
I think it's clear that we're going to see some type of bill, either through a formal proposal from the conference committee or through a formal piece of legislation. So I think it's quite certain that that's coming. The details about what will be included or what wouldn't be included as compared to both what the House and the Senate have passed last summer when we were in session, I think those details are yet to be determined.
Can you say at this point what you might support, what you'd like to see in a piece of legislation like that?
Well, I go back to the bill that we passed in May in the Senate that was, I believe, a compromise that was constitutional. And to me, that's the framework that should be the basis of any pension bill moving forward. And I think the Senate took responsible action in the bill that we passed in May.
And let's go back to that bill just so people can refresh their memories. What was in that piece of legislation that you liked?
Yeah, first of all, it was as much about the content as it was the process. The Senate embraced a process that took into account the opinions of individuals that would be affected by changes to the state's pension systems, predominantly current public sector employees and retirees. And I think that was a good foundation for the bill that we passed overwhelmingly with a bipartisan majority in the Senate. So to me, Sean, it's as much about the process as it is the content. So we did that in the Senate. But there were many things included in the bill that I think are things that should be embraced moving forward. For example, when pension bonds are paid off in full over the course of the next several years, money that was being used to pay those bonds should be put right back into the pension system. They should not be used in the state budget for other spending. We decided that that we should take into account the opinions of current employees when it comes to things such as retirement age and contributions. You know, all of those things were negotiated. The bill that the Senate passed also made a few adjustments to COLAs for retirees, and that was a bit of a controversial piece of our bill, but we felt it was a good step moving forward. But all in all, I want to make the point again that the process that's employed, whether it's through a conference committee or whether it's through the Senate or the House, first and foremost should include the opinions of people that any changes are going to affect.
Well, many of those people are constituents of yours. You have a lot of state workers that fall into your district. And you probably hear different things from them, but are you getting an overriding emphasis from them that they want to see something done just to maybe so this issue is finally decided? Or are you getting more of a feeling, hey, don't touch my benefits?
What I hear most is current employees, both state employees and teachers, are saying let's solve this in a comprehensive manner. And I've yet to hear a teacher, for example, say to me that we can go on the path that we're on today. But at the same time, state employees and teachers are saying you have to be balanced about how this is addressed. And I think the Senate struck an appropriate balance in May, and that bill could be passed tomorrow if the House were to take it up. But that didn't happen, and it doesn't appear as if that's going to happen. But I go back to the bedrock principles of how do we come to an agreement. You know, twisting arms isn't going to get it done. Making certain measures in the state budget or other bills contingent upon pension reform isn't going to get this job done. I think we have to get back to the basics of how to come to a compromise, and that's involve the people that are going to be affected first and foremost.
Let me turn to another issue that impacts your district especially. We got news that ADM is planning to move its global headquarters out of Decatur. And that's not good news any way you look at that. It means the loss of about 100 jobs. ADM says it will maintain the large amount of its workforce in Decatur. But moving those jobs out, now the company's talking about the possibility of tax incentives to keep its global headquarters in Illinois. You've been pretty vocal on that issue that you don't support that idea. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, ADM is asking for something that's unprecedented. And at this point, Sean, I'm not sure if they're asking or the state is offering. to stay in Illinois. But beyond this issue and beyond the specifics about ADM and the circumstance that we are in today, let me say first and foremost, it's important that we keep that headquarters in the state. ADM has made the determination that those 100 jobs are leaving Decatur, unfortunately, but that is not going to change. So that, to me, begs the question, what are we going to do in terms of job creation and job growth for a place like Decatur that has one of the highest unemployment rates in the state? And I think that gets back to a conversation about unemployment statewide and how do we move forward and target our resources in places like Decatur, in places like the east side of Springfield, where we have exponentially high unemployment, places like Macoupin County, you know, where I live, that has upwards of a 13% unemployment today. We've seen for far too long these communities, you know, consistently have a higher unemployment rate than the rest of the state. And I think we have to get back to the conversation about job creation and job retention. And I think that, at least in this case, starts with a conversation about ADM and the 100 jobs that are going to be lost in Decatur.
So are you, just to make sure I'm clear on this, are you looking at some type of something in a package deal for ADM that would help out Decatur in that area?
Yeah, I think an unprecedented request should have unprecedented requirements attached to it when it's in front of the legislature. They're asking us to change state policy, you know, shifting 100 jobs or shuffling 100 jobs from one community in Illinois to another is not job growth, no matter how you cut it. Job growth in Decatur ought to be an essential part of what the legislature should take up on any level in the coming session, because we have to address unemployment in places in the state that have high unemployment. And there's many of those places across downstate and, quite frankly, neighborhoods in the city of Chicago. We have a bit of a disconnect, and you know, we tried to address this through legislation last session, but right now ADM's request, you know, is unprecedented. They're asking for a package of tax credits to keep them competitive, to keep them in the state, which I think is a worthwhile conversation to have. But we just can't lose sight, and we can't ignore the fact that Decatur's been in the grip of unemployment for far too long.
We're talking with State Senator Andy Menar of the 48th District. One of the issues that you're also pretty involved with right now is education funding in the state of Illinois. And for years, we have seen efforts to try to change how Illinois relies so heavily on the property tax and creates maybe disparity, certainly, among many school districts in the state. Where is that process at right now? Can you maybe go back and explain some of the work you've been doing?
Sure. We've had a couple of hearings thus far, and it's a very bipartisan, above-board conversation at the moment, which I think is indicative of the individuals that have made this a true reform effort on the part of the legislature. You know, the bill that we passed sets up a pretty aggressive timeline to produce a new funding formula for state schools. And some of the things that we've heard in the hearings thus far are quite astonishing. For example, the state superintendent of schools at the last hearing gave us very concrete examples of the school districts with the highest tax rates in the state spend the least per pupil. And why is that important? That's important because there was empirical evidence shown to us that there are school districts across Illinois. This is not, you know, specific to a certain geography, but across the state that couldn't tax themselves enough locally to bring about equity when it comes to the richest and the poorest school districts in the state. So a situation like that calls for some hefty reform, systemic reform, many would say. But we've taken a measured approach. And as Governor Edgar reminded me a few weeks ago, you know, this hasn't been done in 15 years, but the world has changed dramatically in the last 15 years. And unfortunately, our school funding formula hasn't kept up with that. So we're taking a pretty disciplined approach to this. But I'm hopeful that come the first of the year, we'll have a bill that can be debated in front of the legislature.
Well, Governor Edgar, at one point, as you mentioned there, tried to make a change similar to what we're talking about here. And even as governor, and a pretty popular governor at that point, with a lot of power in the legislature, he was unable to get that done. Do you think that the desire is there among lawmakers? Certainly, I think they probably see the need in many of their districts to do something. But do you think the desire politically is there to do something?
I think the desire is definitely there. There's not too many members of the General Assembly of either party that would say that the system the distribution system that we have in place today to send money to school districts from the state budget between $4 and $5 billion is one that leads us to equity or leads us to fairness. So I think the desire is there. Of course, the challenge is going to be how do we make sure that we get to a more equitable system without putting too much controversy into it. That was, of course, what Governor Edgar ran into in 1998, and many members of the legislature that wanted to see that reform happen. But I think we've taken a measured approach. We've said plainly in our hearings that we have to spend the money that we have better. So this isn't a conversation about spending more. This is first a conversation about under the scenario that we have in the state budget, how do we make sure that every dollar we spend is first and foremost devoted toward places that need help the most? And then we can go down a path of how do we have much greater degree of change. But I'm pleased. I mean, we've been at this now for several months. We have several more hearings lined up. And I do think that we're going to produce a bill for a full and open debate come February of next year.
Now, while it may be about better use of the money that's already there, there probably would be a hit to taxpayers somewhere. Taxpayers would be asked to chip in more money, though.
Well, no, not right now. Okay. There's two kind of trains of thought in terms of folks that have presented testimony to us in the hearings, and one train is how do we spend our money, and the other kind of parallel path is how much do we spend. My focus has been the how. How do we spend our money today? Can we spend our money better? Can we spend our money in places that has a more positive outcome for students and for teachers and parents and in communities? And I think the answer to that question is clearly yes. We can spend our money better today. The how much question, how much do we spend per pupil, for example, or how much do we devote in the state budget under a belt-tightening situation, that's a conversation for another day. We have to get the how correct before we can get the how much correct, in my opinion.
There had been some rumors, I believe, that you were being considered as a possible running mate for Bill Daley before he decided not to seek the Democratic nomination for governor. Did you have some meetings with him? Can you talk about that whole process?
Yeah, I had several conversations with him over the summer, and more recently toward the end of the summer, as the gubernatorial candidates were kind of going through their process, because it is different this year. It is different because each candidate has to choose his or her running mate, as opposed to the primary process that was employed in past years. But yeah, I had several conversations with him about the possibility of running with him for as his lieutenant governor candidate.
So there was some interest, at least on your part, maybe?
Well, it never got to the point of hey, Andy, you need to make a decision here. It never got that far down the road. But, I'm not dismissive of too many things. I've been in office for 11 months now, and I think people have learned that rarely do I draw a red line on the table and say I won't do this or I will do that. I try to take an open-minded approach to pretty much every decision that comes before me, but the thing that concerns me the most as an elected official and state senator is we have work to do for the 48th district. We have to pass a school funding reform bill. That is imperative that get done this coming session. We have to address the jobless issue in Decatur and across the district, and those things are the things that drive my processes the most.
Well, I guess the first thing I thought of when I heard that there were some of these conversations taking place was he must not be happy with Governor Pat Quinn. Can you talk about that?
Well, I'm not shy about agreeing with the governor when I think it suits the 48th district and the people of the district, and I'm not shy about disagreeing with the governor when I think the interests of the district need to be spoken for. But I think that's just how I operate. I think that's, to me, what my job is in the state Senate. I should further efforts on the part of the governor or any other elected official that help the communities of the 48th district. And if they don't, then I'm not going to be shy about standing up and say, hey, governor, I just disagree with you on this one.